The days are longer, the calendar is filling up, and I want to feel as good as this beautiful summer weather. That's why I've been loving Grüns. It's one daily pack of gummies that covers my greens, vitamins, minerals, and even has 6 grams of prebiotic fiber, so I don't need to juggle a complicated wellness routine on top of everything else. They taste amazing, they're easy to toss in my bag on the go, plus they're vegan, gluten-free, and HSA and FSA, eligible for reimbursement. Save up to 52% off with code PODCAST at Grüns.co. That's code PODCAST at GRUNS.co.
On the Pilot TV podcast this week, we are investigating a murder among an evangelical sect with Ben Aldridge in The Long Call on ITV, doing a little community service with Stephen Merchant and Christopher Walken in The Outlaws on BBC One, and finally, fending off an alien attack in Apple's Invasion, which, let's be honest, was always going to be the next thing we had to deal with after the pandemic. I'm James Dyer, and welcome to the Pilot TV podcast, a show that is heading into the West this week for not one, but two West Country shows. Now, obviously, being a pair of middle-class southeastern twats, neither Boyd nor I could make out really anything of what anyone was saying, so we did the only sensible thing and turned to our very own West Country correspondent, Swindon's Reckoning, the one, the only, Beth Webb. Now, Beth, do you feel that you've really come into your own this week? You've found your niche. This is why we have you here.
Ear.
Oh, sorry.
I'm not being funny.
Oh, that's right.
When I saw
Mr. Frodo,
both Brizzle and Devin on our program lineup.
The only annoying thing is that Invasion could have had a segment set in the West Country as well.
It almost,
I don't know what they're
talking
about, to be honest.
I mean, maybe they're still. Have you seen it all yet?
Not all of it, perhaps.
Well, I mean, maybe.
Yeah, the final episode almost certainly is set in Swindon.
Maybe the apocalypse begins in Swindon.
Yeah. It's this country with aliens.
Yes. Thrilled with the representation this week.
Extraordinary stuff. Now, as we get on to what we've been watching, I'm going to throw down the gauntlet to Boyd Hilton and say, I watched the episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia that Beth set for us. Did you?
No.
Oh, my
God.
No,
I completely forgot. I was so, full disclosure, we earlier this morning we recorded our Succession special.
We did.
And my excuse is that I spent much of Monday interviewing the Succession cast.
You did.
Much of Tuesday preparing for our Succession special and watching other stuff, and I totally fucking forgot. Even though someone reminded us on Twitter, I totally forgot about the It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia episode. Yeah.
So there wasn't one corner of your 157-inch television that you could spare It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
I'm sorry. No, I totally screwed that up. Yeah.
Wow.
Fuck. How was it?
Well, so, Beth, first of all, I would ask you a question, and that's, imagine you're talking to someone who knows nothing about It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. This shouldn't be a stretch for you. What's good about it? Pitch it to me. Like, what's the appeal?
Oh, no. I see the trap that you've set here, James. And also, and I will say, do you know what? I actually went and watched that episode again afterwards because I was like, I want to see, actually, I want to try and picture it through both of your eyes. So I went and watched, also, it's 20 minutes long. I'm sorry, but it's 20 minutes long.
Yeah, boy. What are you playing at?
Is it literally 20 minutes?
It's 21 minutes.
It's not 21 minutes. It doesn't even reach the standard US sitcom length of 23, 24 minutes.
21 minutes.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, okay. Right.
I think it's the wrong episode for you to watch because...
Now she tells me.
Because it is a definitive episode, but what makes it definitive is the fabric of the rest of the show. And I do you know what? I'm getting upset now because I'm like, did he not listen to me last time either when I said that the whole fabric of the show is just every opportunity that these people get to. I mean, it's like, it's not a stretch from Succession, to be honest, except instead of it being New York's elite, it's Philadelphia's like scum of the earth who run a pub. But any chance they have to undercut each other, betray each other, are violent to each other, they do it. And that is the whole premise of the show. And then this kind of diamond in the rough is this extraordinary spectacle of an episode, which actually shows them some rare heart and humanity, but they're egregious to each other. This is it. Look, he's blinking patiently. Like, this is the whole point there. They're egregious to each other. They're so terrible to each other. And that is it. It's back in my kind of gasp laugh brand of comedy, in that you're like, I can't believe these people are doing this to each other. But you were building this up so you can tell me what you think about it. So I'm going to just pass back to you.
I'm going to say it was an odd choice of episode. Ending as it does with a 6-minute interpretative ballet sequence in the rain.
Yeah.
Which I wasn't expecting.
No.
I feel like it didn't feel representative of what I consume is the whole show.
Yeah.
I didn't like it. That probably goes without saying.
Not lying. I didn't like it.
Because, like, so Danny DeVito is hateful.
Yeah.
Absolutely hateful.
Yeah.
I did not find the humor funny. Rob McElhenney's character seemed quite likable. Like, he didn't seem awful at all, which is nice. And he's great. And, you know, again, I was with my Mythic Quest hat on. Yeah. I was finding it difficult to find sympathy for him. But he was quite good. But, you know, when he's talking to his dad in prison and trying to come out, I felt like, this feels like well-worn territory. This does not feel like we are breaking any boundaries here. You know, he's having difficulty doing that. And then Danny DeVito's trying to get him to dance on, like, a float in fetish wear and sticking all manner of things, including, like, dead animals up his nose to staunch a nosebleed. I was like, is this earthing humour I've heard so much about? Because I don't understand it. And then you get to that finale, which, I mean, like, so he goes through an epiphany. So Danny DeVito's character, whose name I don't, Frank. He goes through some kind of epiphany watching this. And to be fair, like, Rob McElhenney, he genuinely, like, that man can dance.
Yeah.
I was very impressed with the ballet on a technical level. And so I guess I enjoyed that as a slice of ballet in the rain.
Yeah.
But I can't say I enjoyed the comedy packaging that it came in.
Yeah, don't watch the rest of the show. Just don't do it.
I can't help feeling, Beth, that you may have failed me on this. That in picking that episode, you may have misstepped.
No. To be fair to Beth, wasn't it? I think I suggested initially that episode because I'd heard about it and I was aware of it being...
Oh, so it's points for. Oh, that's fine.
Yeah, so I don't think it was necessarily Beth's... I think Beth kind of went along with it, but I don't think it would necessarily been your first...
It all becomes clear.
I remember bringing it up because that episode is, I was aware of it's a thing, and I was aware to some extent of the interpretive dance element of it as well, which I was quite fast. So I just wanted to see it. I was like, I want to see that episode because it sounds weird and unusual.
It is.
And I think, you know, I was fully aware that it was a weird, unusual element within the whole It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia universe.
Mm. Yeah.
And I feel like you should have been aware of that.
But
I feel
having watched that, I'd never be surprised by how little I'm aware of things.
Of course.
But it, this one, like, I was in watching it, I feel like from what I saw around that, that my hatred for the main show might be quite extreme.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. That's why I'm not joking when I say just don't watch it.
Yeah. That's why we wanted you to watch it.
Yeah.
Because, just to reaffirm your general...
I'm pretty certain that is not a show for me.
They're just heinous to each other, but I really enjoy it.
That's not the only thing I watched this week. That's not the only thing I watched. So I have started Squid Game. I finally bought it.
Oh!
I'm three episodes into Squid Game. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's almost in macrocosm, like an example of that in media res thing where you have the first episode, which is like into the action. And then the second episode is 3 weeks earlier. Do you know what I mean? Because it isn't literally, but you know, because it takes you out of the action and gives you a load of backstory. Second episode, quite boring. And then it's not until the third episode that you think, oh, actually, like now it's hooked to me. Like the third episode is what grabbed me. Until that point, I was like, I don't understand. I mean, this show looks beautiful. It's got a stunning aesthetic. But it's not captivating. And then the third episode, now I'm starting to see what's going on. Like, it's actually quite intriguing. I think one of the main reasons I struggled initially is that your sort of central character is quite aggravating. And I didn't like him because he's very caricatured and stupid and over the top. Yeah. And I didn't like that.
Of course.
But now that they've broadened the cast out a little bit and you've got the more interesting characters, like the North Korean defector, I like her. I want to know what her story is.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got the cop as well. There's lots of stuff going on. So actually, I was like, okay.
The old man.
Yeah, the old man who's great as well.
Fascinating.
Wait till you get to Tug of War and then Marbles. I mean, the Marbles is the one.
Okay.
Marbles is the one where it turns, I would say, from, a kind of a really good, strong, interesting show with an incredible premise to a jaw-droppingly emotional, devastating thing.
Because Honeycomb is where I'm at the moment. Right. I've just done Honeycomb.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, that's
it's quite brutal.
Yeah. But brutal is the word.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I will say, so I attempted initially to multitask. So I did, I'm sorry, I am Captain Lowbrow. I'm not going to lie, I turned on the dub. I went full dub initially.
Because
I thought I'm going to go dub. I'm going to go dub because at least that way I can check Twitter while I'm watching it. So, look, it lasted all of about 3 minutes because, and I will say, and I can't speak to the Korean translation, which apparently is terrible.
Funnily enough, I can't speak to that.
I cannot Korean-splain to you. But the dub is uniquely awful. Like, yeah. It's so bad.
Yeah.
In that way that, right, you know when we talk about animation and I talk about the way that the thing that bugs me about animation a lot of the time is people don't fucking talk like that. It's so mannered and so over the top because you can see that the actors in their little booth and they act in their little socks off without any physicalities. They put it all into their voice. And I think the thing with animation is you have to tread that line. It has to be slight, like you can't do like Sebastian Stan in What If and do a slightly low energy as if you would in the film thing because it doesn't work. It feels flat. She needs a little bit more life, but it can't be over the top. So it's mannered and caricatured. She's got a very thin line. Yeah. And I think that like the dub on this is so ridiculously over the top. It almost brought to mind some of those awful, you remember like back on, well, before Beth was born, but back when they used to get sort of like TV edits of like Beverly Hills Cop and like, you know, where they would dub in over the, but with a voice that sounded nothing like what it was supposed to do. And it was really, really over the top. It sounds a bit like that. And also,
mother loving.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Stuff like that. Muddy Funster. So that's Harry Enfield. But yeah, but in this, so I always feel like if you're going to have Korean characters, even if you're going to have an English dub, maybe have Korean with Korean accent, so it gives you that immersion. I don't need a Texas drawl, you know. It's like, what are you doing with this?
Who has a Texas drawl?
I don't know, but it's American accents. Like, to the main characters, it's American. They've got American voice actors doing it, and I just thought, you know, let's have a can we split the difference? Can we have a little bit of verisimilitude? So it's in English, but with at least like believable accents, which don't completely take you out of it. Anyway, so long story short, the dub did not last, and I ended up going back to the original Korean, which is clearly where I should have started in the first place. Bong Joon-ho would disown me. So I've got into it, and now, and like, you know, that now I've got past that ridiculous thing. Yeah. Now I'm into it. But my question for you, that incredibly long sort of winding build up, was to ask this thing: Squid Game is a 15. What the fuck is up with that? You is an 18. Squid Game is a 15. You has some murders in it, and it has a little bit of sex in it, but it's not what I would call particularly extreme. Wow, Squid Game is horrifying, and it's a 15.
It's interesting you bring that up because there's a whole moral panic going on as we speak about how kids are watching it, and you know, some apparently in. I mean,
did you read this in the Daily Mail? Is this what's happening?
Yeah, well, I've read it online, probably from the Daily Mail. Obviously, I don't read the Daily Mail, but there are reports. I think probably wrong reports of kids reenacting elements of it in their playgrounds. Obviously, they're not
shooting each other
in the head. Yeah, exactly. So, but that has become a bit of a thing. But I cannot explain why it's not 18. Yeah, that it sounds.
It doesn't make sense.
I always thought that Netflix was very, very reluctant to give anything an 18 certificate.
Yeah.
From, you know, their really bloody, gory film, horror films to whatever, Squid Game. So I didn't even know that you was 18, but now you said you is 18. That is extraordinary. That is ridiculous.
That is surprising to me. Because I would just press forward instantly on the, I guess the reasoning might be that the violence and the manipulation of things in you is quite, not relatable, but more grounded in reality. But then the life that Squid Game has taken on through social media, through TikTok, the way that they're recreating the games as a kind of extension of social media, which young people are on so much, you would think that there would be a stronger set of guidelines against that. Plus, it's pretty horrifying.
I mean, it's really upsetting.
Yeah.
Like, just a mass slaughter of people in it.
The honeycomb one. I mean,
oh my God.
Yeah, the presenter I was speaking to about it on Five Live, one of the 50 million times I have to talk about the show. She, you know, when she described the violence as cartoonish, I was like, fair, you know, it's not dribbles of blood, it's sprays of blood coming out, but it's en masse, it's point blank range, and it's all around you. The honeycomb one was one of the more startling things for me, more than the kind of more subtle emotional kind of kills. But yeah, it's fucking brutal. It is a lot. I am surprised by that.
Yeah, honestly. I think it does show you that I think Netflix is a law unto itself. In every like, you know, they grade their own things. They give them their own certificates. The whole interesting thing in The Guardian about the ratings thing, you know, this whole idea that 120 million people or whatever have watched Squid Game, where in fact they've actually watched the first two minutes of the first episode and all that.
Well, we'll get into that in news because there's a whole thing to talk about there, isn't there? Yeah.
But the other thing, funnily enough, I'm glad you brought up Squid Game generally. And even though Beth is sick and tired about talking about it because she's talked about it on every radio and TV show in the world. One thing that was brought up, which I didn't mention last week when I said I finished it, which I've seen a lot of people tweet about, is the episode with the VIPs.
Yeah.
Right? Which you haven't got to yet.
No spoilers.
So I won't spoil it, but all I'll say is there's an episode where, this isn't a spoiler, there's an episode where American characters arrive in the show. Right?
Yeah. Presumably in the dub with Korean accents. Who knows?
Right. Well, so these are actual American characters played by English-speaking actors. Mm. And a lot of people have said that it ruined the whole fucking series for them because that they are really clunky. Basically, the acting performances are odd either, depending on which viewpoint you take, just shit. Or if you're being kind, like I would be.
Deliberately heightened.
Deliberately heightened. Now, Jamie East particularly of, who, you know, of Holy Moly fame, etc. He does podcasts. I think he's doing a podcast at the moment about Succession. He said that it 100% ruined the whole series for him. This it would be interesting what your reaction is.
Right.
It didn't for me at all. I don't know about you.
Ruined the series for me.
But you know what what I took from it, and then what's brilliant is Stuart Heritage in The Guardian actually tracked down these actors.
Really?
Who play the VIPs.
Oh, fair pleasure.
Which, absolutely brilliant thing to do. And he wrote a feature on what they said, and it totally backed up my theory, which is I think the whole show is a Kubrick fest because the music, they got music from 2001 in it, and there's music from like two or three of his films. And the whole way it's shot and the whole kind of the style of it and the visuals, etc., and the acting style is very, very Kubrick, particularly Eyes Wide Shut. And remember Eyes Wide Shut, when they go to the mask orgy, there are weird mask blokes just talking in the most stilted way. Yeah. And that's what they do with the VIPs in this. So I took it as literally just a tribute to Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah.
And there is mention of the Kubrick tribute element in this article by one of the actors points out, it's all Kubrick related. And the performances in Eyes Wide Shut are often preposterous.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Alan Cumming in it. Do you remember Alan Cumming in the hotel? Ludicrous performance.
Yeah.
So I think that's what it is part of. So it didn't ruin it at all for me. I thought it was quite entertaining.
Yeah.
But it has for some. So I'd be interested to see what happens to you when you get to that bit.
I look forward to it. I've been ploughing on with you as well. So I've been watching them both, sort of like flipping between them. I go, but the thing is, I go to you, the hard 18, for light relief once I've watched an episode of Squid Game. So Netflix, we need to talk. But what have you guys been watching?
Just a brief one for me this week, because I was mainlining Succession this week for our spoiler special, and I've nearly just lost complete. If Squid Game didn't make me lose all faith in humanity, that has. So I went and got it back by watching the second season of Staffelet's Flats again, because I know we've got a third upon us, and it's just one of my favourite British shows not in a long time. British TV has never been better, really, in my eyes. But I adore Staffelet's Flats so much, and the heart and soul of that show compared with just such a wild brand of comedy. I mean, we're not reviewing the new season, I don't think, but we certainly are fans.
No,
because the
host is a monster.
Hang on. I did not veto Staffelet's Flats. You did not suggest Staffelet's Flats until yesterday.
I blame myself.
So it is not down to me. Yeah. I still maintain I would never let a flat from Staff, or indeed watch an episode of the show. But I did not veto it, listeners.
Yeah. Do you know what else I love is how well that show is done in America, given that I recommended it to a friend who lives in New York, and he was like, I don't know what the words are that just left your mouth. Mm. I don't know what a let is. I don't know what a flat is. I don't know what's a staff. And I suppose my accent as well doesn't help, but Staffelet's Flats. He was like, what's a flat? What's left? Like the fact that it doesn't, you know, it's a very British premise to the point where it could be quite alienating. And it's still done absolutely wonderfully. I've just been watching the second season just to bring me back up.
Well, now you've mentioned it. Now I have to admit that I have watched the first episode of the new series because I love it so.
Yeah.
And so we normally cover this in what else is on section in the podcast. But I often think that means anyway that stuff gets kind of, you know, slightly overlooked. Let me say right now, the first episode of series three of Staffelet's Flats is fucking amazing. And it's all, because, you know, remember at the end of the last series, Staff. One woman's pregnant with his child, and another he's in a kind of snoggy relationship with.
That's a great term.
A snoggy relationship.
Let's just say that pandemonium as the child is due to arrive, is hilarious, beyond hilarious. And the other brilliant thing is the whole business, the whole flat letting business, is now entirely ensconced within the one flat, and they all have to kind of vie with each other for space in the living room. And that is inherently hilarious as well. So even though we didn't review it, not only because James is a fascist dictator, but I forgot to mention it in the initial list. But it is brilliant. That starts on Tuesday at 10:15 p.m. which maybe I'll mention that again and also on. But the other thing I finished, Only Murders in the Building, which I mentioned last week.
Yeah.
And I'm going to mention it again because the last two episodes were on this week. Yep. We were a week behind Hulu in America.
Hulu.
But credit to Star and Disney Plus, they put the last two episodes out this week and they did not disappoint. What a app cannot... It's in my top five of the year, definitely, this series. I mean, I love Steve Martin and, you know, everything about the whole setup and Martin Short. I love even more than Steve Martin, probably. And Steve McGomez I like as well. But just the combination of the three of them and, by the way, an extraordinary cast of supporting characters are all fantastic as well. But it's just a brilliantly written and conceived show. And it's really complex what it's trying to do. And yet it does it so light, the lightness of touch. I'm not going to repeat everything I said last week about it. So, but just to say, it absolutely did not disappoint. And it's a fantastic piece of work altogether.
I was saying it's a seasonal watch. We are technically autumn now, so I might just crack on with it. Because well, we're going to have to start our end of year lists pretty soon, I'm sure. So that's going to be one to try out for me. I also watched this week, again, this was the algorithm just feeding me, just shoving it in my face, because it came out earlier this year. I don't know if you reviewed it on here, but Love Life with Anna Kendrick. Did you watch this? I'm not even looking at James here. Waste of my time.
This was on BBC Two.
It's on,
In the UK, kind of late at night, or BBC One, obviously late at night, and was slightly overlooked. Yeah, I think I did mention it, but I don't think we reviewed it properly.
Yeah, I can't imagine why. But it was on iPlayer, and it's this wonderful Anna Kendrick, who I adore. I think she's not been given enough good parts, to be honest. And then she takes the lead on this. Just blocking the view here. Romantic, serialized New York story about this young millennial woman, again, just staring at the floor and not anywhere near James. And the people that she encounters, the partners that she has, it's narrated by Leslie Manville, which is just a wonderful little touch, I think. But then it's got all these amazing performers who I can't name right now, but they're all, it's just a really lovely, nuanced kind of love story that takes place with this great performance from Anna Kendrick, who is just Anna Kendrick in this, essentially just jittery and has this sweet, loving energy to her. But they're doing a second series with William Jackson Harper in the lead. So she's ducking out, he's tapping in. William Jackson Harper of The Good Life. Is that what it's called? Oh my God, what's it called? The one where they go to heaven and hell. And
The Good Place.
The Good Place. Oh God, he's correcting me on a cheerful
American on a comedy.
Sitcom.
I like The Good Place. It's one of the few comedies I enjoy.
The Good Life is one of the greatest sitcoms of all time. Let's not forget that. With Flip Kendall and Richard Bryars.
Yes. Not that one. But yeah, they're doing another season with William Jackson Harper as the protagonist, which I'm looking forward to seeing. But it was really, really lovely. Really enjoyed it. And would recommend to anyone that's not James.
I resent this. And what is it you think I wouldn't like about it?
Well, it's a comedy, isn't it?
It's got light elements of comedy. It's all to do with kind of the nuances. Actually, you liked Scenes from a Marriage. Maybe you would.
I'm a massive soppy twat. Like, I like all sorts of these things.
I
like relationship dramas. I'm all into this stuff. It's only the comedy that would put me off. Jokes? No.
It is like a different date every week, isn't it? Isn't that
it's a different sort of chapter of her love life.
I think I would like this.
Yeah, you might like it.
Shit. Okay.
Yeah. I did mention. I can't remember why we didn't review. I think we just didn't. It was quite late. Kind of arrived late on the.
Almost certainly your fault.
Almost certainly my fault. Yeah. But it was a bit like High Fidelity as well, wasn't it? Which you really liked.
I love.
To be fair.
Oh, you might like.
So I think you. I think you might like.
I don't want to take.
How did you? How were you reminded of the existence of this show? By the way.
The big fat fucking algorithm.
The algorithm.
Like
it
did with Gossip Girl. No. It just went on my new massive telly, and it was like.
So it's on iPlayer. On iPlayer.
Yeah, whole thing's on there.
Oh, good shout. Yeah.
It's really lovely. It's got Jin Ha in it from Devs, who I really liked.
Yes.
He plays a lovely love interest in it. Just really, really good. Really enjoyed it.
Well, we are not going to take a listener question this week. And the reason We are not going to take a listener question this week. It's because the BBC finally published the BBC Culture list of the best TV shows of the 21st century, to which all three of us contributed. So I thought, rather than us answering a question, let's get into this. Let's get into, A, this list, but also, they also published our individual lists.
Yeah,
they publicly shamed all three of us by putting our lists live as well. So I feel that we need to justify our own lists and also comment on the BBC's list. Where should we start? Where do we even begin? Do we look at where they put... I mean, we shouldn't go through the whole list because there are literally 100 shows on this list, and we don't have that kind of time. But should we look at the top 10? Should we look at the BBC's top 10?
Yeah.
So, now, a few ground rules here, which we discovered when we were voting. This is only for shows that began after the 1st of January 2000. So, it instantly disqualified two of the greatest TV shows of all time, including the greatest TV show of all time, The West Wing, but also The Sopranos. And neither Sopranos nor West Wing were eligible for this vote. And a lot of people have been like, what? Why? These are not on the list. It's ridiculous. There is a reason for that. They were disqualified on a, frankly, unfair technicality. Anyway, so with that aside, the top 10 in reverse order are, at number 10, Succession.
Yeah. I mean, this was on mine quite high. And we've exhausted it at this stage because we did a big spoiler special on every
episode. We have. Let's not talk about it.
Yeah.
If you want to know what we think about Succession, just listen to the Succession podcast. We definitely don't need to go into that again. Right. At number nine, The Office UK.
Yeah, sure. I liked it at the time. I've seen things that I think are much better since. And my relationship is that I like it a little bit less now.
Wow. Number two in my list. So I feel personally responsible.
Not on my list. You won't be surprised.
No one's surprised about that. Have you even watched it?
I've watched, I think, one episode and died.
There you go.
Died 100 deaths and crawled under the sofa and realised I could never watch another one.
It is cringe comedy, the ultimate.
Can't do that. And number eight, The Americans.
Yeah, which a lot of people are very happy about, and quite rightly is we've talked about it recently, didn't we?
Well, I'm watching it now.
Yeah, like,
I'm in my first watch through. Anyway, so number seven, The Leftovers.
Yeah, this
very
was
happy
high
about
on
that.
Mine. Yeah,
so am I.
That was
surprised by how high that was, like pleasantly surprised. Yes, so I put it high. So I think they did. I always think that not enough people have seen The Leftovers. But I wonder whether, like, it's one of these things like The Wire where critics have definitely seen it.
Yeah.
And appreciate how amazing it is. Yeah.
And this was a poll of critics.
We should say that. This was a poll. Many, many critics from many countries were polled for this list, including us three bellends. At number six, my favourite show, I May Destroy You.
Yeah. Now, I have to issue an apology here.
Oh. You forgot to put it on your list.
Yes.
Well, it's fine because it's made it into made it at number six.
Thank you.
Maybe if you'd have included
it. Yeah, if you'd included it, it'd be higher.
But I feel like I've let myself down, and I've let the anti-James backers of this podcast down, because the number of times I call him out on this. And what happened was, and I will put my hands up fully, it was a manic week, and I actually sent this just after the deadline, panicked. I think I did pretty well, but it's when I look back and I was like, I've forgotten one of my favourite shows, and it would have been incredibly high. So I'm thrilled it's done as well, but I feel I've let myself down, and I've let this podcast down.
You have. I think that's
and
fair.
So I have to just issue a formal apology.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry, guys. I'm sorry, Michaela.
She does listen.
She does.
Big fan of mine in particular. Okay. I made sure you're number six. And that's interesting because, look, I won't say 100% that when you and Terry used to say this is going to be among the most seismic pieces of television in history, people are going to look at this one. There was a part of me that might have been rolling my eyes a little bit when you were doing that.
But, a part of you? I mean, but, no, we didn't notice you rolling your fucking eyes.
I feel that,
King
yes,
of words.
I have been James chastened. I can accept that I was wrong.
And that's the highest, most recent entry, isn't it? Like 2020.
It is.
Do you know, I think we got the first interview with her for that. Because it was the first one.
Right.
I did it in March last year, and it was still called January 22nd.
Yes.
So it wasn't even called it then, but I think we got first one.
I think you're absolutely right. And I remember reading your piece and thinking, oh, this is going to be incredible.
Yeah.
Because I kind of vaguely knew the premise, but then the more we found out about the premise and the ambition and the boldness of it.
Yeah.
One of it. Like, there are very few shows on this list are as current. Queen's Gambit is at number 100. Mm. Obviously, that's 2020. And Mare of Easttown from this year is in there as well, around the sort of mid-mark, I think. Yeah, 66.
There and I guess Succession is a number 10, which you said.
Yeah, but I suppose
it's current, yeah.
Yeah, it's current. It just didn't start now. Yeah. But interesting there. Right, at number 5, we're into the top 5 now. At number 5, Game of Thrones. Now, this surprises me, not because I think if you ask the public, this definitely would be this high. I'm surprised by how many critics put it high.
Yeah.
Because I did. I mean, I whacked it right up there on my list. But I'm a nerd and I embrace that fact. I would have thought a lot of critics, knowing that their lists would be publicly named and shamed, might have been a little bit reticent to put something like that on there.
Yeah, because, and this, I put Mad Men incredibly high on mine, which we'll get to in a minute, but it is not the most consistently great show, and that is very much the case for me with Game of Thrones. And I'm so worried you're going to start talking in a second, so I'm going to keep talking so you can't get this is my filibuster.
Well then.
But I obviously adored it. I got caught up in, you know, I loved being one of those people that cheered when Arya, you know, drops the knife and all the big reveals. You know, I was there as part of that moment and I enjoyed being part of that moment. I'll be honest, since that show finished, I've barely thought about it.
And like they say about, what's the Avatar, they said about Avatar, don't they? Have made no cultural imprint or whatever. That
he's making 5 wanky sequels.
Oh yeah, so yeah. I would, but I know, but
yeah.
I know what you mean, I haven't thought. I was surprised mainly because these last season was supposed to be such a total bust, generally. Like that's the general. That, I think we have argued against
that. Like yeah, like we have challenged that.
We have challenged that, rightly, and I don't agree with it at all. But I thought that was been such a critical kind of massive opinion that the last season was a complete disaster. Mm. That I was surprised it was so high for that reason, but I'm glad. It's not in my top 10, but I'm glad to see it there because I did love it. Yeah.
At number 4, Fleabag.
Yeah, again, I'm surprised it's this high, but I voted for it. So
yeah,
so did I.
Pleasantly so. And I think that
this is the only show in all of our top 10s, isn't it?
Fleabag.
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah,
and I think that's maybe what's put it is because it's probably quite low on absolutely everyone's list.
Yeah, everyone has it on there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it is, you know, and I don't think it's just on there because, everyone has to include it. Like, it's genuinely brilliant.
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
It's magnificent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And lasting and has made as much as a cultural impact, I think. So I think that is...
Yeah, definitely.
That is fantastic.
It was Kobe from various podcasts pointed out on Twitter that was the one choice that we'd all voted for.
Oh, bless him. Yeah. Good old Kobe.
Yeah.
Now, we're getting into the top 3, and I think the top 3 here really... to my mind at least, distinguishes this from a public voted list. Because Breaking Bad comes in at number 3.
Yeah.
And this doesn't surprise me on a critic list. It maybe would surprise me if it was a public voted list. I would have expected it to be.
Honestly, I would have put it this top 3. Not necessarily in this order. I knew this would be the top 3.
Yeah.
And I didn't vote for any of these shows.
Really?
Partly because I knew they would be catered for in the top 3. And I know... Yeah. But also,
were you tactical voting, Boyd? Is that what you were doing?
Well, I want to. It was half tactical voting. I'm admitting it now. I knew. I just knew because these are the critical darlings of. These are the canon. The canon of TV drama.
Yeah.
Is The Wire, Mad Men, Breaking Bad, and The Sopranos. Now, Sopranos wasn't.
And Sopranos
wasn't
is disqualified.
If we'd been allowed to, it would have won.
Yeah.
I guarantee it would have won.
Yeah.
But part of me, do you know what? I've never watched these 3 shows back since I watched them the first time. So I watched all of these shows pretty much play out. The Wire, I think I got into halfway through season 1 as it aired in this country live, so to speak, on TV. But certainly Mad Men and Breaking Bad, I watched from the start and, you know, loved them. I think Mad Men got better and better as it went by about season 2 or 3 maybe. Breaking Bad, phenomenal right from the start, I would say. And I love them all. I think that I admire and I think they're all fully deserving of their places. But do you know what? I have no urge, just from what you're saying about Game of Thrones, it's not in your mind. I have no urge to go back and rewatch any of these things, any of these three. Whereas I regularly rewatch shows like Fleabag, The Leftovers, The Office, Succession. So that was that's the basis for when we get to our lists. But, you know, fair enough. But I wonder, for me, like rewatching stuff, rewatchability, for me, is the key really about, certainly my favourite shows and the best shows. And I don't know, maybe people do go back and watch The Wire constantly.
I do.
Do you? Do you? Oh, that's interesting.
I've watched The Wire through a few times.
Have you? Oh, okay,
and I love
it. And people do definitely rewatch The Sopranos. I know that. But that's my...
Never rewatch The Sopranos. I've been meaning to. to. Yeah. My Bada binge is still coming.
Your Bada binge. I watch them when they pop up every now and then on Sky. I mean, Sky Atlantic shows them, shows it kind of on a constant loop, and often late at night I'll watch an episode.
Mm. Yeah,
and they are brilliant. But that's my general feeling about the top three.
That's fair. I mean, I'd be interested to know how people have approached this, because I'm sure, like, that's how you've approached yours, and you've put forward other ones that you would sit down and watch again. Yeah. With me, I'm driven by things that break boundaries and things that I form selfishly form like an emotional attachment.
Yeah, but that's what you should do.
Which is part of it. I mean, yeah, but for me, it's the significance, the cultural significance, where they've just presented something completely new, which is, I mean, we'll get into this in the review section. Some things have disappointed me that they've vastly not done that whatsoever. But yeah, the kind of uniqueness of what they're trying to say, the diversity, the voice, and then, yeah, me having this emotional, oh God, the Bellen test. I've adopted it.
You have.
Yeah.
The Bellen test is now the litmus test to which all shows must be measured.
Jesus.
Speaking of Bellens, and number two, Mad Men. Mm. Now, I've never finished Mad Men.
Wow.
I don't like Mad Men.
Whoa.
It bores my absolute tits off. I just thought, you are all uniquely awful, awful people.
Except,
and I think
the men are. But let me just say, like, Elizabeth...
She's awful too. Peggy's awful. She doesn't start awful, but she becomes awful, doesn't she? You know it's true. She becomes a bellend. She does. She does. She does. She does.
She has... there are moments, but not... I don't think they're all awful. I don't think they're... I don't think... I don't think they're all awful.
No, Christina Hendricks is a goddamn sailor.
Yeah, she is.
Joan is the defining character for me on that show. But, I loved it. That was my number two on my list.
Oh.
It did wane by the final season, I think, but I adored it. I think the writing was incredible. The scene about nostalgia, where Jon Hamm is talking about nostalgia as part of a pitch, I thought the ending was quite devastating, where you think he's got out and he's actually been sucked back into
the last
this
episode
kind
is
of,
brilliant.
Yeah,
I agree with you. The last season wasn't
spoiler.
The last episode is fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Please. Right. Okay. Well, fine. Let's move on then to number one. And I imagine everyone has guessed what it is at this point. It is, of course, The Wire, which to my mind was, and will always be the only choice for this, because David Simon's masterpiece is exactly that. I can't, there aren't words to describe. Like, I always say it's like The West Wing is my favorite TV show, but The Wire is the best TV show. Like, that's I will accept that The Wire is better than The West Wing, because I think, you know, you can look at the sort of the fact that it's layers of substrata of Baltimore society, the way every season is a commentary on a different part of that society, the fact that the characters are so believable, the fact that he doesn't make any attempt to pander to his audience. It's just like, you don't follow it? I couldn't give a shit. Like, I always think, like, David Simon, who's quite abrasive on Twitter, like, that persona,
yes,
is quite abrasive. That persona he brings to that is almost what you feel watching the show, that he has no interest in whether you keep up or not. He has a story he wants to tell and a message he wants to get across. And if you follow, brilliant. If you don't, whatever. And I love that about this show. And to your point, Boyd, about rewatching it, one of the joys of rewatching The Wire is because when you watch that first season, I would say for the first two, three, maybe even four episodes, until the fuck, 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 fuck scene, you know, until that, it's very inaccessible. You don't understand who the characters are. You don't understand what they're saying, because they make absolutely no attempt to explain the kind of street jargon that they use. And you're just like, what is happening? And I think a lot of people, like Terry, couldn't get into it at all, ever. And I think, I mean, that's incredibly bold, but also slightly mad. But once you get in, once you crack it, it is wonderful. And rewatching it, I obviously got it from the first second of the first scene. And I loved those first episodes, which I'd never really enjoyed the first time around. And just so many wonderful characters and being part of that world. I remember every time I watched this, you get to that final episode, that beautiful ending to, let's be honest, the weakest season of it. But and just being bereft at not being a part of that world anymore. It is magnificent television. Absolutely magnificent.
I'm going to have to watch it, aren't I?
Oh, yes.
Going to have to start watching it.
See, I now realise that all of that sounded really passive aggressive, like as if I was looking at Beth the whole time. Basically. I had for a moment there completely forgotten that you've never seen what the BBC has just announced as the greatest TV show of the 21st century.
I know.
Why? Explain yourself, Beth.
I've already gone through it. I went through it when Michael K. Williams, I just feel like there has to be a time and a place and a state of mind to give this everything that it deserves. I should have done it during lockdown reading.
I was about to say, if only you'd been at home with just the TV for a long period of time.
So I went down this Sopranos rewatch route because I don't know why. And then I was like, when my cookie Williams passed away, I was like, okay, I'll finally start watching the thing. Didn't, because then I had to watch 20 billion hours of everything else for this podcast.
Sure.
But no, I am just going to watch it. I'm probably going to watch it tonight. I'm probably going to go home tonight.
Well, I think we've set your homework, essentially, is what we've done, haven't we? You need to start watching The World. We could never get Terry to do it because she absolutely wouldn't. But I feel you'd like it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not Terry White. I'm not doing running a small feminist empire and raising a child. So I've got literally no excuse.
You have the time.
Yes.
It's interesting, isn't it? This top three, though. It's very doody.
It is.
It's pretty doody.
I'd say that for it. Mm. I mean, The Wire is very, very doody anyway, itself. If you compile a list of the characters, there aren't that many women, are there?
There are a few great female parts in it, but you're right. It's very much a sausage fest.
It's a sausage fest. I mean, this is not a reason to I'm not saying that in any way undermines it being its position at the top, but I just think, like, all three shows, Breaking Bad, this...
Sopranos is another classic dude show.
Yeah, I mean, at least The Sopranos is a family, it's very much focused on a family, and there's Carmella, or there's The Shrink, But I think, I don't know, I just feel like... Well, certainly, I think that probably affected my vote. This is my personal thing, there's a whole, there's a whole element of culture that is flawed... kind of bell-ending men, really.
Yeah.
Anti-heroes. These are all shows with anti-heroes, aren't they? 100%. And I'm like, come on, I mean, put it this way, thank fuck Fleabag's at number four as
well. Well, I don't know what the breakdown, the demographic of the critics was. I'd assume that they would have tried to make it quite evenly split.
For sure.
Yeah, I know. Well, let's look through the broad list before we go into our own list. Are there any other sort of surprises on there? Twin Peaks: The Return is number 13. That's deranged.
I wasn't surprised at all. I know you hate it, right? But let's not
deranged
forget.
Deranged because it's not within my personal taste.
Yeah, exactly. Classic.
And it is deranged because I personally do not like it.
So right, whereas in fact, it was the number one thing of the year in Sight and Sound. It was the number one film of the year in Sight and Sound.
And if that wasn't the most pretentious thing they've ever done, I don't know what is.
Well, there's a big list of pretentious things they've done. So I don't know, sure if it was, but it was definitely hugely critically acclaimed. And I have to say, I fucking loved Twin Peaks. Yeah. It was potentially in my top 10, but didn't
it. It was in my top 10. BoJack Horseman at 11.
Yeah. Animation.
Our animation.
An animation.
Also, would it beat? Like, it beat Line of Duty. Yeah. It beat... it beat The Handmaid's Tale. It beat...
Yeah.
Friday Night Lions. It'd be everything. I'm really, really surprised by that. And I watched all of it and I liked some/half of it. That is, and not just because of my personal taste, because my dreams are, but because I'm just astonished that it quite had that read on people.
It has become, I watched it kind of last year because it had become, reached such a cultural kind of apex or whatever, so much so that it's getting quoted in Succession, of course. I'm going to get the BoJack right.
I love this side by side as well.
Yeah, exactly. So I am aware, I think that it's become like it's definitely entered the stratosphere of cultural stuff that people refer to. And it is really good. It's a good point I should mention. My friend Sophia, who is known as Queen Guna on Twitter, said this. She's tweeted this week, "I want to put myself forward as the Pilot TV animation reviewer because I feel like those of us who do like animation are missing out on proper reviews for these kind of shows." Well, I've completely granted.
And I sit firmly in the animation camp. One of the storyboard artists from BoJack Horseman did an amazing, amazing show called Tuca and Bertie, which I really, really love. And I think that is doing more interesting things than BoJack Horseman.
Interesting. But BoJack Horseman is brilliantly written, and I would say that for it. Some of the stuff in the dialogue in that show is fantastic a lot of the time. So I was really impressed with it from someone who, obviously, famously, we're all us lot are famously animation stupid, animation ignorant.
Except Beth.
No, I'm going to use. Listeners, I'm pointing at me and us two, along with previous co-hosts.
And Terry.
And legend Terry. But I did really enjoy watching BoJack Horseman, genuinely enjoyed watching it. But I was surprised it's a number 11. That is
It's high.
Yeah.
Crown at number 16.
That's boring to me. I'm sorry. I know it's very, very, very good, but I find it just such a boring choice.
Really?
Yeah.
A boring choice or a boring show? Watching the show?
A boring choice.
Okay.
I think it's just boringly good. Like, if it's like a
boringly good,
it's so like.
I think the last series was the least boring, because when you bringing Thatcher and Diana in made it a lot more thrilling for me.
Yeah.
So I think that's a big element of why it made it in this high.
Of course,
I think that series was particularly kind of entertaining.
Yes,
from that point of view,
I'm not saying it's bad at all. I just think sure. It's obvious, I guess, in what I'm trying to say. Whereas it's an obviously very good, very powerfully performed show about the monarchy. Whereas I prefer something like The Great, which is like outrageous and
great,
fun
is great.
And black and has great performances and doing interesting things.
Chernobyl at 15. I was surprised. I thought that would be higher, I have to say, because that was universally acclaimed.
I thought Deadwood would be higher. That's at 18. That's one of the classic dude bro top fives, isn't it, generally?
Lost, I mean.
Lost at 19 seems a bit nuts to me. But
what, it's higher? Or low?
That it's high. I thought most people had kind of accepted that that went wildly off the rails, but
again, I think it did go. I think there is a lot. Me, I think it went off the rails massively. But I think because it was so influential and bold for a network show, prime time network show, I think it changed TV.
Yeah.
I think from that point reason, just, it. I don't mind it.
What it could have done if they'd known what it was about.
I know.
What else? We got Better Call Saul at 23.
Yeah, that's like good stuff.
Line of Duty comes in at 27. At 28, Friday Night Lights, a show. Beth, you should watch that. It's good. It's good.
We're all saying that. It's what they're all saying.
Be you to it. I'm going to get together before he does.
Any other surprises? On the Bridge at 34, I'm assuming that's Broen rather than, you know, the remake of The Bridge.
Yeah.
Which would make that the highest rated non-English language one. We've got more down.
What
Borgans in at number
bridge?
40. The Bridge is at 34. The Borgans at 40.
Yeah.
Downton Abbey at 36. I mean, I love a bit of Downton, but really?
That is ridiculous. I have to say, I love Downton as well, but that's fucking preposterous.
Grey's Anatomy at 47. I mean,
people love that show, though.
But it's just a show that's gone on for a very long time.
But I watched, I think, the first 8 seasons of Grey's Anatomy.
I genuinely did.
Wow. Like, I watched a lot of Grey's Anatomy.
That's amazing.
And I enjoyed it, but at no point did I think it was good.
No.
Like, do you know what I mean? No. Like, it's a guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
But that's nuts. At 51, obviously, a film, which was interesting. We'll get to that when we talk about your list, Beth. I think we'll soon get there. What about all the Shield?
We haven't said what it is. Excited.
Small Axe, a selection of films. It's fine. What else is surprising you, Boyd, as we get down the list?
I'll tell you a couple of things that surprised me. Dark at 58, which is the weird, freaky Netflix
the German one
show. I was surprised that was in there so high, but I know it does have its fans.
Avatar The Last Airbender, I didn't expect to be on there at 61.
That is extraordinary. That must be an online campaign of some kind. I don't know.
Maybe.
I mean, the fact that those are higher than, you know, the OA, which is 88. Has to be observed and mentioned.
RuPaul's Drag Race. Now that's a 67. That's the first unscripted thing I've seen on this list.
Is that the first one?
To the best of my knowledge, I haven't seen anything above it that's unscripted,
that's
unless
amazing.
I've missed something.
That is pretty amazing.
So that's on there as well. Stranger Things 24, 68, 69. Battlestar Galactica comes in at 70. Gilmore Girls at 72. Beth.
Yeah.
Planet Earth at 73. It wouldn't even have occurred to me to vote for that.
That did not cross my mind.
The original Utopia at 74, that surprises me just because, again, I didn't think that many people had seen it, but it is so good. Rick and Morty at 76. American Crime Story at 77 is an interesting one because you've got to think, like, are they referring to it as a whole? Are they referring just to the OJ season?
I think it's heavy OJ, yeah.
Yeah, because OJ's at 81 as well for OJ Made in America.
Which is phenomenal. Mm. I was thinking about that. I think of all the documentaries, I think that is my favourite. Yeah, that's an astonishing piece of work.
Normal People at 84. The OA, boy, the OA at 88.
I mean, at least it's there.
It is on there.
Yeah.
Considering how high it is on my list, I think it probably...
You're responsible for this.
I like to take credit for that. It's even there,
The only thing on this list I genuinely have never heard of is at 99, Steven Universe. What the hell is Steven Universe?
I'm not surprised because it's an anime show.
Oh, right. Okay, fair enough. I was like, what is that? Like, it's the only thing I've not heard of.
Very long-standing anime show.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm surprised to see it in this.
Right. We have banged on about this list, I'm sure, long enough. Do we want to very quickly go off our individual lists and justify what we did? Who wants to begin?
I'll go first because I spent such little time on it. So I'm just going to run off really quickly. And again, I do take these things seriously. I'm sorry. I was just frazzled and a rush. I'm sorry, Michaela. Temma's Fleabag. And it was Broad City for me. I really, really, really loved Broad City. Curb Your Enthusiasm at 8. Succession 7. Twin Peaks The Return 6. Leftovers at 5.
What's that noise?
Yeah, what was that? was that?
That was me expressing my distaste.
We're beyond words at this point. It's just like carnal noises. I've lost my place now. 6 Twin Peaks, 5 Leftovers, 4 Veep, 3 Atlanta, 2 Mammoth, and I did number 1 Small Axe because I just thought, if there is there a case to be made for this being a TV show? Yes. Can I champion it? Yes. I'm going
to. It's absolutely a TV show. Don't
Steve McQueen
to it.
Refers to them as films.
Of course he does. Yeah, but their films he made for TV.
Yeah.
He made them expressly to be watched on television.
But you know, the fact we can say it and it was shown on iPlayer and it's films TV, I'm gonna say it.
It's in the overall list, so there's no debate. It's a fucking TV show as well. It's a film, a TV show which is a film.
Yeah. And I just I will fly the flag for this forever. Like, it's an extraordinary, extraordinary anthology made with the most care and patience and wonderful performances. And it again broke boundaries, which for me is one of the most important things that a show should seek out to do, especially now when we're just like flooded with shows and channels and streaming wars. I think something that can really stick with you, pack an emotional punch, and just break all kinds of boundaries, which is what this has done.
For example, by not being a TV show. That's another thing that it broke a boundary. Anyway,
Number one with a bullet, Small Axe for me.
Now, Boydie was horrified because, like, when we were doing this, and I said, "Oh, Boyd, what do you vote for?" And my assumption that all of your list would be unscripted. Put Big Brother at number one?
Can you believe it? What an absolute fucking twat.
But you talk about, like, Big Brother.
I took all kinds of things. It doesn't mean I think they're the greatest things of all time.
No, but I suppose I don't think you should take this as me sort of looking down my nose at your reality TV. It's like, at number one, Boyd says, Brookside. It wasn't that. I suppose it was more that I see you as being this sort of oracle of television, being so broad-minded that you would include all of these various things and weigh them up based on their influence and all these things, and that you wouldn't dismiss them, as I myself clearly would do.
I mean, that's true, obviously. Yeah, I mean, I'm not a complete cultural snob like you, and I wouldn't dismiss them. But no, my favourite stuff is scripted and, you know, comedy and drama. I love all kinds of TV, and I was interested, some people voted for Gogglebox, I noticed, was in a couple of people's lists. But no, my list is scripted stuff, yes, because that's my favourite stuff. I had Happy Valley at 10.
Yes.
Quickly. What I would say is, having watched the first 7 episodes of Succession, season 3, I would put Succession in my top 10 now, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
I was surprised it didn't see it.
I considered it heavily, but then I thought, it's still going on, who knows? Maybe. And this was before season 3, maybe season 3 is going to be a crushing disappointment. Yeah. Unlikely as it may seem. Now I've seen it, I'm like, okay, it should be in the top 10. Happy Valley 10, Line of Duty. I think Line of Duty is an incredible achievement.
Agreed.
And I've rewatched it, and it works on rewatching. Curb at 8, which I think is the same as you. Haven't been to see the new series, by the way. Furious about that. 7, I May Destroy You.
Because you remembered.
Sherlock. A lot of people put their eyebrows raised at Sherlock. Someone tweeted me saying I was an idiot for picking Sherlock.
Why?
Why did they? Yeah.
It's magnificent.
I absolutely adored it. It gave me so much pleasure, every single episode, even the ones that were stupid. Fleabag at 5. The Night of the greatest limited series, I think.
You got a lot of love for that. I saw
I did get a lot. Yeah, that was good. That was nice to see.
It's on my list. Nobody cared.
The Leftovers at 3. The Office at 2. And
UK. UK.
The Office UK. And I did go for the OA predictably. If anyone knows me, predictably. And I do stand by the fact that it's one of the most astonishing things ever put on television. And the season 2 climax is the greatest, boldest, most audacious ending to a TV series ever. Yeah. So, you were asking whether my vote was tactical and not including The Wire and those shows and Mad Men and Breaking Bad, I genuinely prefer these shows, I think, in the end. I stand by it. So, yeah. Fuck those shows. They're brilliant, but they're not my... That's my pick, yeah.
Yeah.
I scored 2 hits with the BBC's top 10. 2 of mine are in identical place to the ultimate list.
Yeah.
Which I was quite pleased with. But I began at number 10 with a little show that Boyd and I have seen called Friday Night Lights. It's very good.
This
joke will never end, ever. I went back and forward over my number 10. I struggled with whether I wanted to put this on the list. And I wonder whether, if I hadn't recently done a rewatch, it might have been something else, because it really might have been. You know, I toyed with State of Play and all sorts of things. I couldn't work out what I wanted to do with that, because I think that's probably the second best limited series. But so, number 10, Friday Night Lights. At number 9, The Night Of, which, as Boyd said, is unbelievably good. At number 8, Fleabag. At number 7, The Leftovers. Number 6, The OA. Boyd was disgusted that it wasn't higher. At number five, The Shield, which I love so much, I can't even tell you. At number four, Battlestar Galactica, which didn't get anywhere near enough credit on this list. I mean, it's on there, but it's not high enough. And then my top three, at number three, as with the main list, Breaking Bad.
Right.
At number two, not Mad Men, obviously. My number two was Game of Thrones, because it's, and again, like, I may have seen it again recently, but I will go to bat for that show, like, in terms of scope, in terms of ambition, in terms of everything it achieves, the feels, just, that is definitely my number two. And then my number one, obviously, is The Wire, as with it seems everyone else. Ooh. So The Wire at number one.
Fair enough. People complained that Doctor Who wasn't in there. I don't think Doctor Who was strictly eligible, because I haven't checked this out.
It's not. It wasn't eligible. You know, it literally started in the 60s, didn't it?
Yeah. But I think people thought, because it would be the reboot officially.
Yeah.
Who knew who started in this century?
Right.
But that's not enough for this list. I think it was discounted.
That's an interesting conversation, because whether or not it is, because if you look at some of the TV wikis, like, they do treat it as a separate show.
Yeah.
I mean, it isn't.
I agree. I don't consider it to be separate.
But it's kind of like the show was essentially just sort of like kickstarted again, wasn't it? There was a gap, and then it starts again. But it is the same.
That's why I didn't consider it. And I knew it wasn't. Yeah. So but people have been asking that a lot.
They have. That is true. Well, that was our incredibly extended discussion of.
that was like a podcast special.
We should have done a podcast special. Like, we've got no time to do anything else now. Yeah. Fine. If you do want to look at the list, it is on the BBC website, or Google it. I think we've all tweeted about it at one point or another. So, excellent stuff. Now, let us very. Hopefully quickly. Should we talk a little bit of TV news? There's been some news that's happened this week. Let's start with Why the Last Man. Why, God? Aww. Why? Why the Last Man has been killed by Hulu. It will not be returning, certainly not on that service. It has been cancelled. Eliza Clark did tweet about this, say she was absolutely gutted. She's never been more committed to a story in her life, and she's hoping that they will find a new home for it. Some people have mooted HBO Max as a possible destination for this show. Now, I was reading up on this, and as something, it seems to be less to do with viewing figures and more to do with retention of cast, in that they, because the production was so drawn out because they recast it, you know, Barry Keoghan dropped out, they had to get in Ben Schnetzer, rightly or wrongly, you know, the monkey was being a nightmare, I don't know, but... But for instance, they had to keep paying large sums of money to extend the cast contracts. And I think at this point it came up for renewal again. They needed to extend the cast contracts, and they elected not to, you know, lay down the millions it would require to do it, and instead opted to cancel the show. I have to say, I'm up to date with Why the Last Man. I've been watching it. It's good. It's not great.
Right.
I think it has the potential to be great.
Right.
But it's taking its sweet time getting there, I think. I'm not loving it as much as I thought I would initially. And I part of it is, I think, the Yorick factor.
The
Last Bellend thing. Because he's very unlikable. He's unlikable, as we've discussed in the comics, but he's really unlikable in this.
Okay.
And I have struggled with it. But it is really interesting. And I think it asks really interesting questions about gender and roles in society and the very fabric and the strata of our society. I think there's a lot to get into.
Yeah.
And I kind of... not to be uncharitable, wish they'd maybe do more of that and spend less time titting about in Costco, which quite frankly has been the last three episodes. But anyway, so I mean, do you think this is a big loss? Like, how do you feel?
I didn't continue, not and because this is my life now. Like, this is a bit of an adjustment coming into play, because I've watched so much television, and I'm also a film journalist as well, so I'm balancing the two. So much as I would really actually like to carry on watching it, I just have not had the time. That's not to say that I don't think the episodes that I did see weren't incredibly spirited, and I really enjoyed some of the breakout performance in this, especially. I wasn't as put off by Yorick as you were, James. I kind of liked the soppiness in him, and that he is a Walking Smith song, and like, just sympathetic in that respect.
Maybe the best description I've ever heard.
But I think we're in a time now where perhaps we can not worry too much, because I
cull the herd. Is that what you're saying?
No, in that I feel like somebody might just step in. I think, again, because of the shape of streaming now, unless it's something really shitty, like what happened with the OA, like what happened with Glow. I'm still pretty salty about what happened with Glow, because Glow would be coming out around now, I think, or in the next few months, and I still would very much have enjoyed watching Glow now. I think they made the wrong call with that, and what's worse, they weren't able to pick up anywhere else. I don't know what the deal is with Netflix. I'm sure you know a lot more about it than I do.
They're not inclined to let people pick them up. I think when they kill it, they kill it.
Yeah, it's very hard.
Whereas I feel like here, Hulu will happily sell it on to someone else.
Exactly. So I think whereas it is a shame, and it is a shame, especially given, you know, Eliza made a point of saying about the cast and the directors and the crew and how, you know, it's setting the bar for things like that. I sincerely hope that it's just going to be a case of passing hands and not like a Netflix Glow OA situation.
I hope so. I would like to see more of this. I really would.
I get the sense that, I mean, I really liked the first episode, and I kind of quite like, I did like the next couple that I watched, but I don't feel, I have a huge compulsion to carry on watching it. And I feel like viewership's probably tailed off a bit.
Costco, kind of I'm telling you.
Costco.
Nobody needed three episodes in a Costco.
And let's just say that I've had quite a few approaches from, you know, people working for the channel to write more stuff about that series, and then you get this announcement in the middle saying it's been cancelled, and I think there's a reason for that. So I'd be surprised if anyone picked it up, actually, because people do see the figures for these things, and I wondered if it has, if the number of views has tailed off that dramatically. That says something.
But it's a Vertigo property, and you know DC's natural home is kind of HBO Max. Maybe. So
I mean,
who knows?
I think it was so brilliant that first episode that I would be happy to see.
It just peaked very early, I think. But like I say, it's not a bad show. I have been enjoying it. Let's hope that it finds a home. I think that would be good. But you alluded to this earlier, Boyd. There have been some Netflix discussions about how they rank their shows. So they talked a little bit about Squid Game. So Squid Game, according to their metric, which is their old metric, which is, again, as we said before, if someone walks past a house in which it is showing, that counts as a view. Squid Game racked up 142 million views over the first 28 days of release. And kind of to put this into perspective, that is nearly twice Bridgerton. Mm-hmm. Nearly twice. So Bridgerton was the highest rated. This is Pitt Bridgerton. It is now double, more or less. So Bridgerton's at 82 million. Squid Game, 142 million. I'm actually lost for words as to how this
literally
has become the phenomenon it is.
Yeah.
So that's the first part, which I think we've talked about before, how this has become the phenomenon that it is.
But I've talked about.
They are now changing the metric, aren't they? It's going to be now less about that 2 minutes of viewing time, which where they've always hung on to, and now it's going to report the number of hours watched in the first 28 days of release. Is this going to be more accurate? Is it going to make any difference? Is it just as arbitrary as the other one?
What do we think? This in itself, because for so long they wouldn't give us anything. Like, we didn't have the top 10, did we? That ranking. They wouldn't give us even this. So the fact that they're now starting to whittle it down, it just shows the sheer magnitudes that they're working on now. Like, they have to start giving out data with these things. And the 2 minutes, I mean, the way that news works, they are just going to pull that headline. And I feel like people really do only care about that headline.
But it's more stark now. So if you look at the old metrics, 142 million views over 28 days.
Yeah.
And then Bridgerton, 82 million views. If you go by the new metric, Squid Game has accumulated 1.4 billion hours of viewing time in its first 23 days. And Bridgerton's still in second place, and that's only 625 million. So it's actually more than double Bridgerton now.
I think the second metric, the new metric, is at least a reflection of actual engagement with a program.
Yes.
Which is important. 2 minutes of a thing.
Yeah. Means nothing.
That's literally just saying that you have been affected by the hype and
Word of mouth surrounding it. Literally autoplays.
Yeah. Right.
You can be on the menu screen and see 2 minutes.
It could barely be more meaningless. Is that what it says?
Yeah.
That is the metric. And now they've got a new metric which means something.
Yeah.
I thought that piece in The Guardian about, I don't know if you saw it, it was about The Guardian, about the whole idea of Netflix, you know, telling us their ratings effectively and how meaningless that is I agree with it, because basically they don't have to, because they don't have advertising, and it's completely not in any way affected by advertising whatsoever, that it's just completely irrelevant to them. So the only interesting thing is the how the comparison is, you're right, is the fact that so many more people have watched Squid Game than Bridgerton. That's the interesting thing. You know, take the pinch of salt, the actual numbers, all the rest of the numbers. But within the Netflix universe, what does well and what in relation to other shows, that's interesting.
How many of those 1.5 billion were children. We should ask the Daily Mail, find out. And, yeah. and subsequently putting their classmates through Squid Game trials.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I mean, when a show's watched by that many people, then you can have a moral panic coming along instantly. Fair enough.
Right. What else has happened in the world, people? Has there been any other news?
I'm just going to mention one thing that you're going to probably take out for the final edit because it's...
Why do you do this to me?
Sorry. But I really am fascinated by it. There is the prequel series... Right, to John Wick. So that is newsworthy.
Ah, yes. The Continental, starring your friend and mine, Mr. Mel Gibson.
All I'm going to say is, don't worry, James, I'm not going to whisper on about it enough and call him an anti-Semitic abusive bigot that often. But let's face it, if you want proof that the so-called cancel culture it does not apply when it comes to Hollywood fucking stars, the fact that Mel Gibson is still working and going to be a key cast member of this huge big project, The Continental, which is a three-part Stars Channel prequel to John Wick, then this is the proof. That's all I will say. You can cut it out if you want.
No, I wouldn't dream of it.
Fucking Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
I mean... There's just no excuse, is there?
There's just no excuse.
How many other people would be really great for that role?
Oh, I mean...
Thousands.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. So let's just say that. And the other thing I was going to mention was, have you heard about the show Extrapolations?
No, it's fun to say.
Okay, so this is just to say that this is, of all the, this is a Scott Z. Burns climate change anthology drama series for Apple TV+, but this is the cast. Meryl Streep, Sienna Miller, Kit Harington, Tahar Rahim, Matthew Rhys, David Diggs, Gemma Chan, David Schwimmer.
Could they not get anyone good?
Yeah. So, I mean, fucking hell.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a thing that's happening.
Probably be watching that one then.
Yeah. I think we'll watch that one.
I'm sure there's other news out there. I'm thinking, let's just move on anyway.
Yeah.
Because as we enter this podcast 15th hour, I'm saying we should probably just skip on news. I'm sure if you need to find out what's gone on in TV, you can Google it. It's fine. Right.
I say that every week.
It's true.
But still.
Let's move on to this week's reviews then. And first up this week, we have Invasion, which is Simon Kinberg's rather low-key look at aliens attacking the Earth on Apple TV+. Who wants to take this one? I'm looking for volunteers. Boyd will. Boyd, what did you think of Invasion?
Deep breath. I was really looking forward to this. This is where I would begin. You know, I'm a fan of the stuff, Simon Kinberg X-Men films, and...
Were you?
Yeah. Well...
one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I visited the set of one of them years ago. The one that had Kelsey Grammer in blue.
Ah!
Yeah.
That's a Brett Ratner one.
I'm sorry, that's X-Men Last Stand. Oh my God, talking of cancelled people. Yeah, okay. Anyway, so I have a fond history with the X-Men. some of them, some films are better than others. But I, when this was announced, this whole idea of doing a big epic science fiction show about an invasion of aliens, basically the War of the Worlds.
Yeah.
But very now and covering lots of different characters across the world in kind of disaster movie style. I've mentioned before on this podcast that I love disaster movies. I love Independence Days and that, you know, which is where basically the whole format is you meet a collection of disparate characters who are all going steadily being affected by the same huge disaster, whether it be a global thing like Independence Day or a towering inferno or an upside down ship in a Poseidon adventure. I just really like disaster movies and that whole format. And this is, basically, is it 10 episodes? I think a 10-part disaster movie writ large where you're following a disparate group of characters from all different parts of the world, America, Afghanistan, soldiers in Afghanistan, London, students in London, et cetera, et cetera. And an alien invasion is happening and you're seeing it through their different perspectives. And all I would say is, it is no War of the Worlds. And even War of the Worlds, which we reviewed, I think we maybe did review both series. I think we did,
War of the Worlds and War of the Worlds.
Right, which was on Fox Channel here, and then it moved to...
This has more in common with that one.
Star on Tube. And it does have a lot in common, and there are a lot of similarities. I think the idea of both of them is that it's kind of showing what would it really be like, you know, in as gritty and as realistic a style as possible. I'm saying the theory of these shows, of that show and this invasion, rather than making it a kind of cheesy, over-the-top kind of thing like Independence Day in 2012 and those films that I love. Yeah. So this is trying to be a bit gritty and authentic, and and it's holding back on showing. So we don't really see the aliens. I've halfway through episode three, and you know it's being you see glimpses of things, of spaceships and aliens and things happening, and there are certain patterns that are trying to people have kind of almost deafened by horrible things happening in their ears, and other people just seem to drop dead without much reason, and bad things are happening on a global scale, and we're seeing them played out through the eyes of these different characters. I just think it's unbelievably, preposterously slow.
Yes.
Every scene goes on for five times as long as it needs to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Every major occurrence in these first few episodes that I've watched takes way too long to happen. They repeat themselves again and again and again. Like, yeah, we get the idea that the boy in this pops up in episode two in London, the London set stuff, is bullied and, you know, has kind of fancies one of the other girls. And that's like takes ages to play out. And then weird creative choices in the show, right? So this the London-based element, which is basically like a kind of kiddie sex education kind of thing playing out. And the guy who's in charge of them,
Tom Cullen.
Thank you. Yeah, Tom Cullen, who I love, who's brilliant in everything from Weekend, etc.
Yeah.
Like there's that climaxes with the thing, I won't spoil it. A big thing that happens, and then it cuts from it and it doesn't go back to them again for like hours on end. You have to wait till the episode three. Meanwhile, the really boring characters, one character's having an affair, the family where the dude's having an affair and the wife knows it, and there are two kids, they are unbelievably tedious. Repetitive and annoying. There are the soldiers in Afghanistan. Like, if you want to, you know, all right, there's interesting things to be made about American soldiers in Afghanistan. It's not saying anything interesting or new in the context of this show, but the decision making is just weird. There are loads of reaction shots, like heavily Steven Spielberg style influenced, the kind of thing you get in Close Encounters and indeed in his War of the Worlds, which I maintain is a brilliant, brilliant film, which does everything this show does. In 2 hours, and this is still grinding on for 10. You know how Steven Spielberg will show you the reaction shot before you know what they're all looking at, and you'll see an array of cars looking at something astonishing, and then the reveal would be a massive gigantic alien or a massive gigantic tripod thing or huge big spaceship in Close Encounters. In this, it's like nothing. Cuts to their mass reaction shot, and there'll be like a murky corridor on a spaceship. Maybe you're like, oh, what are they fucking surprised and shocked and stunned about? It's nothing in particularly shocking at all. It's incredibly underwhelming, is my bottom line.
Yeah.
I was astonished by how underwhelming it was.
Yes. I'm going to step into old man shaking fist at cloud mode here and say TV these days is too long. Television is too long.
Of course.
It was my main qualm with Queen's Gambit. I didn't need to see 8-9 hours of that. And I certainly, and I will not be seeing 10 hours of this fucking show. Oh my goodness. And it's not even, so the first episode of this, it's interesting. We're talking about Why the Last Man because it's essentially the same thing. It's essentially training a bunch of characters in various different positions, various different ethnicities, various different, you know, genders, sexualities across the, you know, and then this event starts to happen that kind of sets it all off. But what happens with Why the Last Man is that you are emotionally invested with these people. You're curious about these people. There's stuff you don't quite know about them yet, but you want to find out more about these people. I couldn't care less about a single person in the show in kindness. That's not to say it's not doing an awful lot for diversity, but it feels like it's doing it for diversity's sake. So it's for the sake of having a queer character, for the sake of having a black soldier in Afghanistan. Because there's nothing to these characters, especially. I wrote in my notes, like, video game dialogue. In it, you know, it's these very almost like clunky interactions. But I feel like even video game script writing has gone on boundaries, you know, things like The Last of Us. There's real emotional connections and power behind these people and what they're setting out to do. But this just felt like box checking. The little boy, the bullied little British boy, got on my fucking nerves.
Casper,
the bullied lad. Also,
who's an amazing artist, of course.
An amazing artist. Another shake my fist at the cloud moment. Can you just let kids listen to music from their own age groups. Like, just let kids listen to their own shit. Like, don't, like, they don't all have to listen to Dookie and Green Day and Nirvana or, like, you know, like Otis in Sex Education and his vinyl collection. Just let them listen to whatever the fuck
BTS is. Or
yeah, just allow that little bit of BTS in there. Like, it really irks me when, like, these kids have to listen to, like, essentially the showrunner's favorite bands.
Yeah.
Because, like, yeah, that's apparently all they're capable of listening to. But they just feel like no character development, no emotional stakes. Again, this was my issue with, I've even forgotten it, I'm sorry. What's your one, your other Apple one that you loved?
What, Foundation?
Yes.
The magnificent Foundation.
Oh, steady.
Which, you know, was epic and spoiling. It did wonderful things with visuals. But again, it's just shadows and insinuation to begin with.
No, but the shadows are from Babylon 5.
and just not enough emotional drive. Even the heightened drama of some of the trajectories. So Goldshifty for Farahani, who was in the Adam Sandler film with Jim Jarmusch, Patterson, she was in, and I really enjoyed her in that. And in this, she is essentially a wonderful, wholesome woman and wife and Harvard medical school dropout, which I'm sure I haven't found out yet. I'm sure you still don't know, 3 episodes in, 4 episodes in, why she didn't go to Harvard. Maybe we'll never know. I don't really care. But yeah, so she's the one whose husband is having the affair, and she's got to be there for the kids. And you would think that would have more of an emotional pull, and there really isn't.
They're the boring family I was referring to.
Yes.
Thank you for naming them. I couldn't have been bothered to look up there. But they move from one bit of the house to another, cowering and shouting at each other, and it's so tedious.
Yes.
That's the primary plot line.
Oh my God.
That is 100% the primary threat. She becomes more interesting when they go on the road, I think, because he's banging a foodstagrammer and that all kind of kicks off. But, you know, they end up stealing a car and going on the road. Like, she becomes more interesting, but there's more to that. I think with these sort of alien invasion things, you can take the Roland Emmerich approach, can't you? You can take the kind of top down, let's look in the seat of power and let's see things blowing up and let's know what's going on. Or you can do what, not to bring up Mel Gibson again, but you can do what Shyamalan did with Signs, which is take a really microscopic view of what happens, like from people who are uninformed, they don't know what's going on, they're not privy to what's actually happening, and it's the day-to-day on-the-ground reality of what an invasion would be like. And in many ways, it is a more interesting story to tell. However, I think you're both quite right. It reined this shit in like Christ on a bike. It takes so long to get where it's going. And I get what he's gone for here. Like, he's tried to say, well, what we're going to do is, in the same way that The Walking Dead has human drama set against zombies, what we're going to do is we're going to set this invasion as a backdrop and have these individual threads of human drama with their own shit going on. The problem, and I think you both touched on this, is that those individual threads aren't really that interesting and the characters don't feel fully fleshed out. So you're like, okay, if this was brilliant human drama set against this sort of cataclysmic event, you know, I get quite into that.
Yeah.
But what you've ultimately got is some quite dull human drama that's occupying screen time when you're waiting to find out about the alien stuff.
Yeah.
I watched 5 episodes of this. It doesn't speed up at this point. Maybe the second half goes a mile a minute. Whoa. I don't know. But for the first 5 hours of this, it's this glacial snail pace. And you're just like, what is happening? And they don't mention aliens, they don't mention invasion. But that's really odd because the prologue of this features clear extraterrestrial input. And that, again, just threw me completely. I'm like, fine, if you're going to do if you're going to delay the reveal, do it. But don't drop it in the first scene and then forget about it for 5 hours.
Yeah.
That seems a little bit of an odd choice. So this felt like a very me show. It's alien invasions. It's lavish. It clearly cost an awful lot of money.
Yeah.
But it ultimately, it's just a bit boring.
Yeah.
Like, it is. It's a real struggle.
It's too long.
I think I'm pretty sure, I was trying to look it up on my emails, I'm pretty sure it was described in one of the press releases of the show as playing out in real time. Now, it's
yes,
not.
Yeah. It doesn't.
But it feels like it. Sorry, we all knew where that was going.
I remember
it really
that.
Does
yes. Yeah. Well, they said it plays out in real time. Yeah. And you're like, it really doesn't. But oh my God, it very much does go that way. Like, and not all the characters, the drip feed, half the characters are not even introduced until the second episode.
Yeah.
Some characters you actually starting to get interested in then sort of like disappear. It's, yeah, like, I applaud the effort, but ultimately, I think probably not.
Yeah.
But it's not, I mean, look, I gave this 3 stars. I reviewed it for Empire. I didn't think it was like the worst thing in the world. But will I press on with it? I don't know. We'll see what happens. But that is Invasion. And that dropped on Apple TV Plus on Friday, last Friday. So many of you will be in the process of watching that in real time. Godspeed. next up, we have The Long Call. And you will remember the delightful Ben Aldridge telling us about all this last week. But this sees Ben as a man who returns to his hometown years after having been ostracized by the religious sect with whom he grew up, this time to bury his father, but also to solve both a murder and a kidnapping. It all happens in the West Country. Beth, please translate for us. What was this about?
So Ben Aldridge, as you say, he is Detective Matthew Venn, and you meet him sort of returning to the community for his dad's funeral. You get a sense some are more pleased to see him than others. And then, yeah, there's a murder of a mysterious man with an albatross tattoo around his neck. Guys, there's some significance in that tattoo, I will tell you. But yeah, it takes place in this very idyllic, I would suspect quite Brexit-y town in North Devon, represent. But it's more than just a ITV detective drama, of which there are thousands. And I will say I look forward to the day when we see a detective show where the detective is like, not even just like happy, but okay. Just like okay. But they're not like battling with addiction or the death of their child or, you know, detaching from an evangelical cult, like whatever. It would just be nice if someone was all right. But he's obviously not. D.I. Matthew Venn. But there's also, you know, you're learning a bit more about the fabric of the community as you go along. Obviously not everyone's quite as they seem. But this detective cell thing as well is so he's gay, he's in a same-sex relationship with somebody else in the community, which is, you know, something quite new in that respect within this genre, certainly that I've seen, and isn't forced in. I hate it when things like this, when queer storylines or feminist storylines are kind of just shoved in for the sake of it, whereas this is approached in a really just nuanced, matter-of-fact way, and I really like that. I've only seen one episode of this, and I'm desperate to see some more because I'm actually really, really invested in this community, in these characters, and where this goes from here. But he is great, Ben Aldridge. I'd only seen him in Fleabag. I'd only seen him as an asshole. He's not an asshole here. He's very watchable, very sweet, has a very open face. I'm looking forward to finding out more about his past because, again, that's also paced in a really nice way as well. So you do start to find out more and more about why he left and you know, the relationship with his father and that he was still going to visit him even though he wasn't technically allowed to. There's a lot of bad blood between him and his mother. So that's all established in really well-paced ways in this first episode. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing more of it.
I found the interview, actually, Boy, that you did with him last week fascinating because he comes from a similar background to his character in this, a very religious sort of evangelical. Did you say they were Plymouth Brethren or similar?
Similar, yeah. They're evangelical, yeah.
Yeah, and he too, obviously, as a gay man, had to kind of step away from that. So the parallels here are stark and had nothing to do with his casting either.
It is unbelievable how there are so many similarities with his real life story and the story of the character, Matthew Venn, are completely unconnected because, you know, Anne Cleese wrote the book, you know, who writes the Vera books and Shetland. So it's just complete coincidence. Yeah. He read the audiobook. I think, you listen to mine. But what I like about this this drama, as you're alluding to, Beth, is that, you know, this is a primetime ITV drama going out, stripped across the week, 4 episodes. And it's about this gay man who's a lead detective, and it's about his sexuality and his identity as much as anything else, much as the whodunit element, which is, you know, all very well, and the whodunit element is interesting. You know, there's a dead body in his community that he's going back to, but what plays out is that he has this very difficult relationship with this religious sect, this Christian religious sect, and that's why, without, I'm trying not to spoil it, but his personal previous life and his upbringing and his sexuality and his identity is all woven into the fabric of the mystery. And I think that's really clever because it means that even though this is the first time, as it's established in an interview with Ben, that we've seen a gay male detective character in such a prominent role, primetime mainstream British television. But more than that, it's also about religion and faith and their, frankly, you know, unwillingness to embrace a gay man as it is anything else. And I think that's a real, that makes it, so it's kind of like a character driven, issue driven, with that horrible phrase, but not in a kind of preachy way, if you pardon the preaching, pardon the word preaching, it's all about Christian religious people. So I just find the whole thing fascinating. And the mystery keeps you going as well. And the cast, I mean, you know, as you say, I think Ben, he's great, but Ben is great. Yeah. Very, very likable and interesting. You've also got, you know, Pearl Mackey kind of as his number two, he's kind of in the investigation. She's always great going back to Doctor Who days. Anita Dobson pops up from EastEnders, could not be more different, you know, from her role in EastEnders. Martin Shaw is the head of this religious sect and he's really creepy and weird. Juliet Stevenson as his mum, and the scenes between her and him are really interesting. It's just unusual to see this kind of thing. It's unusual to see the religious Christian sect dealt with, you know, in a primetime TV drama, let alone then how it can't deal with sexuality, etc. So I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. I thought he was very compelling for all the same reasons you said. I think there's so much going on here. The least interesting thing to me was the murder mystery.
Yeah. Like
that was the least compelling part of this. That's not to say there's anything wrong with it, but there was so much else going on here. Like he's having been ostracized from the community, him going back, why his mother banished him, you know, him trying to get back in to sort of see his father when he's dying. So much stuff going on. And then, of course, the abduction storyline, which comes in, which is very compelling as well. Mm. But yeah, but this feels really... Like, I'm glad they're doing this. And you bring this up in the interview, that they're doing this across 1 week to make it an event. But like, I got to the end of this episode and I was like, this is 100% a night after night show. Like I was like, I need to go straight into the next one. It was that kind of thing. You want to just devour it in one sort of weekly sitting. But yeah, for me, this is very compelling.
They should have done, I think, with Hollington Drive, Sophie Petzl's show, you know, which only went out weekly. Mm. And I forgot to mention this in the what we're watching. I thought the ending, the denouement of that show was fantastic.
Really, I haven't seen the finale yet.
Yeah, because I hadn't seen either. I watched the first three and then I watched the finale live on ITV when it went out on Thursday, and I thought it was a really brilliant solution, kind of what actually happened was really clever. So yeah, I encourage people to watch that.
So actually, that would have been a nice one too. I mean, I believe Sophie mentioned it, but for logistical reasons, I think, you know, that wasn't a possibility. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, The Long Call does air on ITV tonight on Monday at... I'm going to say...
9 o'clock.
9 p.m. I'm going to say 9 p.m. Yeah. It feels like a 9 p.m. show.
You would be right.
9 p.m. on ITV. And the last show this week is competing for that particular slice of airtime, airing as it does also tonight, Monday at 9 p.m, but over on BBC One. So this is The Outlaws. This is Stephen Merchant's new series, which looks at a bunch of probationary reprobates doing community service in Bristol. Thankfully, we still have Beth here for this. I'm saying with this, think Misfits, but without the superpowers.
Yes, to some extent. Yeah, that's quite a good comparison. Now, he created this show with Elgin James of Minds FC.
Yes, who took over after Kurt Sutter left as well and co-showed with him before that. Yeah.
There you go. This is a really fascinating show because on the one hand, it is Stephen Merchant creating a series of comedy characters, disparate group of characters brought together who are all doing community service in Bristol, and they've all committed mostly fairly minor crimes, a variety of crimes whereby certainly they're not going to end up in prison. They are doing community service. And at the same time, and there's like, so Stephen Merchant's character, for example, is a classic Stephen Merchant dweeby, you know, kind of doofus comedy character. And yet at the same time, there are these young characters played by Rian Barreto as Rani Gambacol as Christian, who are kind of hovering at the edge of dealing with like gangs and small-time crime in a kind of, you know, urban setting. And I'm guessing that that's where the Elgin James, I was thinking like Elgin James is in there almost like as an expert on gangland. And, you know, crime. And Stephen Merchant's, you know, this is a simplistic way of looking. I'm sure this isn't the case, but I see Stephen Merchant tapping away, getting brilliant jokes out for Christopher Walken to spout, who's this character called Frank, who is a ludicrous kind of old school, old duffer.
Yeah.
And it's really funny. So his stuff is really funny. Everything that Christopher Walken says is classic Christopher Walken, brilliant. Yeah. And it's astonishing that he's in the show, wandering around Bristol with Darren Boyd and all the, and you know, etc. And yet there's this kind of thriller element going on. So the last kind of, the ending of the first episode, for example, is a kind of a little mini thriller thing going on, which I thought was very well directed and shot and acted as well. And you really care about why they've ended up, you know, kind of involved in this small scale crime that they are involved in. And Eleanor Tomlinson's in there. I thought she was great, almost transformed from her role. She was in Poldark. She was Demelza in Poldark. She's now playing this.
I almost didn't recognize her.
She's playing this, this ludicrous but funny influencer who's obsessed with TikTok and, you know, being on Instagram, etc. Dolly Wells plays Christopher Walken's daughter.
She's
brilliant, obviously, in everything. I really enjoyed it. I think Stephen Merchant is brilliant at this stuff. I think I think the dialogue is realistic and yet really funny. I thought that it's brilliantly cast. But just to see Christopher Walken, I mean, in this context, in this world, is so weird. And I interviewed him for Empire, and it was one of the greatest opportunities of my professional life to speak to Christopher Walken. But he loved it. He was like, yeah, you know, Stephen Merchant made me an omelette and I agreed to be in his show. And, you know, I love him for it because it's so odd, but it kind of works. It somehow works. This whole disparate thing. It's a thriller. It's a drama. It's a comedy. It's got Christopher Walken.
That is the question here. Like, I was playing genre tennis in my head, and I couldn't work out what this was.
Well, yeah, but it doesn't matter.
Maybe it doesn't matter.
You know that thing that critics always. And I've probably said it myself, I'm sure, many times. But you know, tonal shifts and all that. But it's fine. It kind of. I think all the different tones of it come together pretty well.
But
for me,
like, you've got on the one hand Stephen Merchant comedy, and then suddenly you're watching County Lines.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was just like, and it's really dark.
Yeah.
And like something with me, like, I found it a bit of a stretch because I wasn't sure where my head was supposed to be at. And I sometimes wasn't sure which emotional strings it was pulling on. So I think maybe I like my stuff to fit in neater holes than this because it does defy kind of.
It really does. Yeah.
Identification a little bit.
Yeah. I thought the gang thriller stuff was a little bit thinly drawn, probably because it was lending to so many other genres. I feel like Darren Boyd got all the best lines.
He was really good. Yeah. He was great.
I thought they really saved him as this...
Peak Bellend.
Yes, peak Bellend with a heart.
Did he have a heart?
Well, he's like, you know, I think this is very charming. I love the thought of Christopher Walken walking around Cabot Circus, going to River Islands or whatever. In this. And, I'm sorry, Gabby was... I couldn't get on board with her at all. Eleanor Tomlinson's character, I found her, like... I found her awful. I think
she's supposed to be awful,
but I don't know what would... I just can't foresee a situation where she's... redeemed for me. I think it's so wonderfully charming. I think the characters are obviously created with the most love. I just think I've seen all of this before. I've seen the kind of this kind of ragtag bunch of low level criminals. You know, you've got Christopher Walken kind of as Danny Ocean. He probably does a few kind of slightly less
a shit Danny Ocean.
Like a shit Danny Ocean. Charming, and it did make me laugh. Mostly, again, Darren Boyd seemed to get the funniest lines, and I think he's just in step with Stephen Merchant's comedy a lot more. So he's got that delivery just down already. And I'm glad they've brought in someone else to write the younger characters, especially with the themes that are being brought in there. I've said it. My thing is, I like to see new ground broken. That's usually a big thing for me. And it just felt like it was quite well worn to me at this stage. The stuff that's gone on here.
Yeah, I'm probably closer to Beth's camp in this. In that, I didn't dislike it, but it didn't get me. Part of it was I think the genre thing. But other than that, there was a part of me just thinking, yeah, like this is like Misfits, but less fun and without superpowers. Give me superpowers, what I'm saying.
You're really into that Misfits comparison.
I want superpowers, and then I'll be more interested.
Look, Misfits did not have Christopher fucking Walken.
No, it didn't. It didn't. True. Although, you know, again, I wasn't... Like, I enjoyed him. Mm. I did enjoy him, but he didn't make the show for me.
Okay.
And I wasn't particularly invested in any of the characters. I know what you're saying, Darren Boyd does have the best lines, but I disliked him, and I didn't really care what happened to him. Eleanor Tomlinson's character, again... I'm not saying this, I'm not liking this just because it fails the Belen test. It's more just, I just wasn't really invested in any of their stories. And, you know, they have this sort of probationary supervisor who felt a little bit, this is Jessica Gunning's character, Diane. She felt a little bit of an archetype that had been sort of dropped in there. And again, it felt like a different show. Like that felt very much like heightened comedy send-up stuff. And then you go into this County Lines drug deal stuff, which is quite bleak and a little bit, you know, almost upsetting. And I just, they felt like a weird chimera of two different shows that had been sort of rammed together.
Yeah.
And obviously it worked for Boyd, so I'm not saying it doesn't work.
A weird chimera.
Yeah, the weird chimera. But for me, the weird chimera didn't
work. I think actually for me, funnily enough, that weird chimera is what made it different. So it's like, yeah, we have seen these elements before, but not in this weird chimera.
Sure. And you're not wrong.
Thumbs up for the weird chimera.
Yeah, if you, like Boyd, enjoy a weird chimera, then as we've mentioned, The Outlaws airs on BBC One tonight, Monday, October 25th at 9 p.m. Now, there are other things out this week which we have not been able to review. First and foremost among them, Boyd, the new series of Doctor Bloody Who, which starts on Sunday. But we weren't able to see
it. BBC One, not no, still in the edit, apparently. I did try it. I did bother the BBC every day, every hour of the day. So that does arrive on Halloween night itself, Sunday the 31st.
Exciting stuff. We might talk about that next week, possibly.
Yeah, hopefully.
We didn't see Curb either.
We didn't see Curb.
News is the Curb Your Enthusiasm. That's tonight as well. That's Monday at 9 p.m, but they didn't make episodes available to us.
They didn't. They did make episodes of Show Trial available, but we would have. For us to review that. This is the big news Sunday night, also starting on Halloween night at 9 o'clock.
The Vigil slot.
The Vigil slot. And from that production company that makes Vigil and Line of Duty. So this is quite a big deal. But we would have had to delay the arrival of the podcast to Tuesday because of the Tuesday embargo, review embargo. I have seen it.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. And it's about a trial of a young woman who's accused of leading to the death disappearance/death of a fellow student, and she's an incredibly privileged young woman from a super rich family, and it's all about, is she being judged for her privilege, etc.
It's Legally Blonde.
Yeah, I mean,
it's Legally Blonde 3.
But a thriller. But it's very interesting, but I can't say what I think of it because it's embargoed.
Yep.
So there's that. Oh my God, there's so much this week. Stuff Let's Flats, which I mentioned earlier.
Ooh.
Tomorrow, Channel 4, Tuesday, 10:15. A bit late, but it's cool because of Bake Off going on for hours before it. Temple, Series 2.
Season 2,
on Thursday, I've seen this. I fucking love Temple. I really like Series 1, but Series 2 is a major, major step up.
See, this is interesting because I was off the week you reviewed it on this podcast. I've never watched Temple.
Oh my God.
I've never seen Season 1. I love Mark Strong.
Mark Strong and Danny Mays is like the central duo. They're brilliant together, bounce off each other brilliantly. It's a really interesting, quite lavish. It was shot in lockdown and London looks incredible. They've used the fact that London was empty to film some fantastic London locations. So it looks amazing. Plus, Michael Smile and Reese Siffans joined the cast in really, really entertaining characters. They are really good.
Brilliant.
It's just a really well-written, well-shot and directed show. So I really, really am into Temple, as you can hear me turning leaves of my magazine. Insecure is back for its last ever season on Tuesday on Sky Comedy, and now that's a really good show. It's a Ray's show.
I love it. It's back. Right.
Tuesday.
Good. Wonderful.
Tomorrow. Los Espookies on Sky Comedy on Friday is about a group of friends who turn, it's like a horror comedy thing. They create horror film situations among them. It's supposed to be really funny.
Yeah. The Good Fight, season five. Yes, comes to more four.
Oh my God, loads.
I know. It's a hell of a week.
Jesus.
Colin in Black and White on Netflix.
Yeah, the Colin Kaepernick show.
Which I have seen some of. Mm. That is the Colin Kaepernick show, which is really weird and interesting. He literally narrates and appears in the show, the real Colin Kaepernick. It's almost like, imagine like the Wonder Years, or what was the one with, you know, the one, comedy dramas about kids, but where he's actually in the picture looking back at his own life, like, dramatized.
Is it Young Rock?
Young Rock. Looking back on it and commenting on it and kind of almost lecturing us on it.
Ooh.
It's really interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure quite what to think of it, to be honest, but that starts on Friday on Netflix. I mean, there's probably even
I think that's broadly it. A busy week then, we're saying. So I know what Beth's pick of the week is, I think, but go on, tell us, Beth.
Yeah, it's The Long Call for me.
Oh, yeah, same.
Yeah.
And same for me as well.
Yay.
We are unanimous. The long call, then, our pick of the week. Well, that is it for this week's show. If you've not already, do download our Succession special, which dropped last week, which not only includes us banging on about the Bellends, but also features some of the Bellends themselves, containing, as it does, interviews with Brian Cox, Matthew McFadden, Sarah Snook, Alan Ruck, and Jay Smith Cameron. We are also receptive to your 5-star ratings if you happen to be passing by Apple Podcasts. And if you want to swell our Instagram followers, then please do so at James C. Dyer, at Beth K. Webb, and at Boyd Hilton. We will be back next week, where I suspect we may well be talking about some of the many shows we weren't able to talk about this week, like maybe Curb and Doctor Who, but I am sure there will be other exciting shows in the mix as well. Probably. Anyway, until next week, pilot out.